Liz Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is
True Crime New England.
What's up, everybody?
Hello, welcome back to another episode.
Thank you for joining us. We are, God, Katie, we are just so thrilled. We're pumped to have you here today. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. Yeah, we have a case today that I personally hadn't heard of until we came across it on our list.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a pretty important one to get out there. It's just really sad.
It is so sad. And man, something about our podcast just is constantly really sad. But I think it's one of my favorite things to just talk about these sad cases and get the stories really out there.
Yeah. Favorite as in important. Like, it's important. So important to get them out there.
Yes, of course. I would never mean favorite like I love the pain and suffering.
Right.
You know? That's psycho behavior.
When we say we're excited to talk about these cases and do what we do best, which is shedding light on them.
And sharing. It's very interesting. And before we talk about this case today, which is, it's got so many twists and turns, and there's like a death within a death. It's a lot. We wanted to touch base on something that's been kind of blown up in the true crime world lately. And it involves an old true crime case, not super old, but from the early 2000s, the murder of Lacey Peterson out in Modesto, California. So for those of you who haven't heard or maybe don't know about the case, basically Lacey Peterson, she was 8 months pregnant with a little boy they were going to name Connor, when one day she just disappeared from her home, and her husband, Scott Peterson, had a really shitty alibi. You know, he said he was going to go out in his boat and, you know, golf stuff. It was just really not adding up. And then 4 months later, her son, who was in her womb, separated from her decomposing body, and his decomposing body washed ashore. And then a mile away, her body washed ashore. And they were discovered. And it was very obvious that Scott had killed them, had killed his wife. And then after death, I believe the baby, you know, during decomposition had expelled from the body and they washed up separately. It was very obvious from the beginning with his terrible alibi. He had a secret girlfriend that came out and was like, what the hell? It was very obvious he was guilty the whole time. It was a very similar situation to Chris Watts. Those of you who are familiar, who killed his wife, Shannon Watts, and their two daughters. Shannon was also pregnant with a little boy. So he's just guilty as hell. He's been in jail for quite some time, almost 20 years, something like that. Well, all of a sudden, he's been in the news again lately because he's been picked up by the LA Innocence Project. And we want to talk about it real quick to misspell a rumor, because it's so important to misspell this rumor.
Yeah, and even the article I pulled up to get a refresher right before we recorded this says the Innocence Project has taken on Scott Peterson, which is incorrect.
No.
The Los Angeles Innocence Project, which is not even a chapter. It's, in one article, it said wholly independent.
Yes.
Like, it's their own thing, their own nonprofit, their own little version.
Yeah.
Whereas, as we talk about a lot on the podcast, the Innocence Project, the New England Innocence Project, which is a branch of the Innocence Project, we love them.
Yes.
We've covered multiple exonerations we found through them.
Yes.
You know, we've donated money to them independently, as well as through our swear jar, one of our rounds.
Yeah.
You know,
we encourage you to do the same. We encourage you to support them. They're wonderful. They do amazing things. This is different.
You know, and really curious to see how it develops, because me personally, I am pretty set in my feelings that Scott Peterson is entirely guilty, no question about it. I am curious to see how this unfolds.
Yeah.
I sure do hope that he's not wrongfully exonerated, if that's even a thing.
Ugh.
But yeah, a lot of people are giving the Innocence Project some flack over here. Mean comments on their social media and just like, wow, the Innocence Project sucks. I'm not going to give them any more money. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, wait.
No. Separate entities, even though they do have the same name, the Innocence Project.
Yes. And I will not lie to you. When I first saw that pop up on our newsfeed for our Instagram account, I was like, excuse me? I got real pissed too. And then I saw it and I looked in it and it said the LA Innocence Project. And I looked and I was like, oh, thank God. It's not the Innocence. Oh, thank God. Because we all know it. All of us people with, you know, sound mind know that Scott Peterson killed his beautiful wife and his unborn child. Without a doubt. This fucker was so guilty. He burned his boat afterwards. He was caught, like, mixing cement and all this stuff. Like, he was so full of it. So guilty. So, like, without a question. And his whole wrongful conviction ideal, like, he's trying to base it off of, like, theories that were posed against him. I'm gonna really, really hope that this, of course, as we all are, that this just ends. That it goes nowhere, as it should. And he continues to spend the rest of his life in prison, as he should, because he's a piece of garbage.
Right, right. And, you know, as you guys know, we are all for exonerations. Like,
absolutely.
And I'm sure that for most of the people that have been exonerated, I know that for a lot of them that we've covered, Liz, mm-hmm. up until the exoneration, people were convinced, like, oh no, this person killed that police officer without a doubt. Like, without a doubt in my mind, this person's guilty. Yep. It's such bullshit that they're being exonerated, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Which is, like, we don't feel that way about this case.
No, no.
You know, like, there's, in our minds, there's no question that this man is guilty. Mm-hmm. Exoneration is, it, I mean, our whole prison system fucked.
Yeah.
Okay, the fact that people even need to be exonerated, there's a lot of things stacked against them. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, they are wrongfully convicted black men.
Yes.
There are a multitude of things stacked against them from the day that they're born.
Yeah.
Let's be real. For Mr. Scott Peterson, doesn't seem like a whole lot is stacked against him.
No.
So, I just very... I don't know. Innocence Project does a lot of great things. Los Angeles Innocence Project, I'm sure, has done lots and lots of great things.
Sure.
This, I have my doubts.
I have your doubts for you as well. Because damn. And they are losing all credibility right now. And I think that's a very popular opinion. If you guys have heard about this and maybe don't share our opinion, let us know. I want to hear what you think. Because... maybe I just haven't looked into it too much, but Scott Peterson is guilty as hell.
Yeah, this is a really, really hot topic, and obviously it has nothing to do with New England true crime,
right.
But it has a lot to do with true crime.
Yeah.
And as we are a true crime podcast, and it's not uncommon for us to do like a little intro mm-hmm. on hot stuff going on in the true crime world. I mean, yeah. We've talked a lot about breaking news and yeah. updates and cases, and this is no different. So we, as always, are so curious about what you guys think.
Yeah.
Let us know, because this is... it's popping right now in the media.
And it is one of the Lacey Peterson case is definitely one of the more popular, quote unquote, modern true crime cases. It's up there with, like I said, the Shannon Watts case. It's kind of up there with like Jodi Arias, Casey Anthony, all like the early 2000s, you know, 2010s cases that everyone just kind of knows the name, whether they don't really know what it is, but they know that it's like a true crime case. That's really what this is. So let us know what you think. If you have any inkling of what's going on, but I think we all know how this will play. I hope it plays out that he just stays where he is because he did a terrible thing. And speaking of that, we're about to tell you about a man who also did a terrible thing and similarly to Scott Peterson continues to this day to keep trying and appealing and appealing and appealing to the courts that no. I would never. And yet he remains in jail as well. So isn't that interesting how that works?
Big thank you to Mary Beth L., who suggested this case to us via our website submission tool.
Thank you, Mary Beth L. This is a fascinating case. Just the details alone of it and how it's kind of all wrapped up into such a weird box. Like, it started with a murder of one person and then it resulted in the murder of another, and just there's a whole bunch of moving parts. It's very interesting. So stick around, guys. And without further ado, today we will be covering
the murder of Jennifer Rivera.
Okay, Katie, let's start this story off as we always do with our sources.
Sure. I have information from a case law find law, which is court documents, of course, as well as turn2ten.com, WPRI, CBS News, Law Gestia, and the Hartford Current.
Beautiful.
I used quite a few law documents. I used two find laws. I used the CBS News. I used the Providence Journal. I also used a case law find law from Law Gestia. And I also used a law document from Case Tech Search. I had a lot. So I had four total law documents. And boy, were they good. I just love them. They're so helpful. They give all the information and they teach me legal jargon.
Yeah, hell yeah.
So I feel like I could maybe get by representing someone very poorly with very low expectations.
You know what? Better than you representing yourself.
Thank you. That's all I ask for. So if I ever had to represent myself, I think I could do an iota of a centimeter of a portion better than Ted Bundy.
That's pretty good.
Just kidding. He knew more than me. He was a law student. Doesn't matter. Because I'm never going to murder anyone. Anyway, this case, guys, buckle in because it's got a lot of moving parts. And like we said, it's layer after layer, but it's important and it's fascinating in its tragic way. And I'm going to start us off today by telling you about the murder of a 17-year-old boy. You ready, Katie?
Oh, I'm ready.
Awesome. On Saturday, August 28th, 1999, 17-year-old Hector Feliciano was working on a car he had just bought, and he was working on that in an empty parking lot behind his house in Providence, Rhode Island. He lived here with his mom and his older brother. According to Hector's older brother, Carlos, he was in his bedroom at about 5 p.m. on that Saturday evening, he being Carlos. Suddenly, he heard several gunshot sounds, like all of a sudden, just out of the blue. And of course, this is not common, so he was alarmed and he ran to the nearest window in the kitchen. He looked out and he noticed a blue Blazer, which is a kind of car, with tinted windows, driving away very quickly. He didn't think the Blazer car had anything to do with it initially. He thought maybe that they were scattering from the sound of the gunshots, like maybe it was like they were spooked as well. And he went back to his room, maybe a little frightened, but maybe thinking like, oh, maybe it was something in the distance, or maybe it was the car itself that made the sound. Your mind goes somewhere else. You know, you want to think it's the least terrible scenario because you don't want to be scared. You don't want to think your life's in danger, you know? I would be like, oh, it was a car. It's fireworks.
Yeah, maybe it was a car backfiring 5 times in a row.
Right, right.
So scary.
Exactly. So once Carlos had returned to his bedroom, he suddenly heard shouting. And after a moment, he realized it was a friend and that they were yelling that his younger brother, the aforementioned Hector, had been shot outside while working on his new car. Carlos ran outside to find that his brother was laying in a pool of blood on the ground, and police were already at the scene. So obviously for Carlos, it probably felt like a long time had passed, maybe even the opposite, that it was very fast, but enough time had passed that police had been alerted and they were already at the scene. I think as soon as the gunshots really went off, usually people are pretty quick to call. And this was not a neighborhood where that typically happened. So it was a quick response. Surrounding Hector's body were 4 9-millimeter shells, all within 4 to 8 feet from his body. It was determined that they, obviously, had come from the same gun. They had been hollow point bullets, which I don't know much about guns, but hollow point bullets, I know, are devastating. They're those ones that are small enough, and then once they go inside you, they explode into many fragments, and they create the most amount of damage. So they really, really are very deadly and cause a lot of harm. You use hollow point bullets when you want to hurt someone very badly. According to the medical examiner, it seemed very likely that one person had fired the shots and in very quick succession. And it looked like one bullet just barely grazed the right side of his head, and the other one got him fully in the head, which killed him instantly. Also, near his body, just about 8 feet away, was a black pager. Yes, remember, this is 1999. People still had pagers. Or beepers, whatever you want to call them. It was several hours later when police got the call that there was a potential car fire on Elmwood Ave in Providence. When they got there, they realized it was a blazer. And if you'll remember from just moments ago, Carlos, Hector's brother, noticed a blue blazer outside of his window, driving away very fast after he heard the gunshots. So once the fire was put out, the fire department quickly determined that this car had been set on fire as an act of arson, as three separate spots in the car had been set on fire, as well as the facts that the car had clearly not been broken into or damaged in any way. It was very intentionally left there, set on fire, and I don't know why this person maybe thought that that would be inconspicuous or that maybe would burn the car completely and just fizzle out and that was it. Like, no, sorry. Luckily for Hector, if you can even call it lucky, there were several witnesses to the aftermath of his murder. Not only, of course, his poor brother, which is terrible, but several of his neighbors. Hilda Carrasco, who lived in a first-floor apartment next to the vacant lot, heard the gunshots and promptly looked outside. She clocked a vehicle that she noticed idling a few moments earlier, describing it as a blazer. Okay, so now I think we've established that a blazer is involved. After the gunshots went off, she looked out the window again. She noticed this blazer speeding off. And I think being a true crime lady, no doubt, she immediately read the car's license plate and attempted to commit it to memory. So that's awesome. Hector had another neighbor, 15-year-old Jennifer Rivera, who was cooking in her kitchen when she heard the gunshots ring out. She very bravely looked out the window and watched clear as day as a man hopped the fence bordering the vacant lot, got in a gray Jeep, and drove away. Little did Jennifer know that seeing this scene and watching this man hop the fence and genuinely being a good person in being a witness to her neighbor's murder would actually be the cause of her own demise.
15-year-old Jennifer Rivera of South Providence, Rhode Island, loved to dance, spend time with her friends, and she loved the rapper Juvenile.
Huh.
She had recently transferred from Roger Williams Middle School to an alternative school back in March because she had gotten a few too many suspensions and a few too many arguments with teachers. She was a good kid, just kind of had a hard time in school, had a hard time with authority, it seemed, but genuinely a good kid.
Yeah.
Nina Villafane, one of Jennifer's closest friends in eighth grade, described her as having two sides. In the final weeks of her life, Jennifer was also described as being scared. She was the state of Rhode Island's star witness in the murder trial that was now right around the corner because the previous year she had, like you said, Liz, seen her friend and neighbor, 17-year-old Hector Feliciano, get shot in the head. He was shot twice, actually, and she, you know, was cooking dinner, looked out the kitchen window, and saw the scene. One of the other witnesses was a 14-year-old boy who saw the man run into the lot before he heard gunshots, and Jennifer had seen him hop the fence and run out. So obviously the same guy.
Right.
The 14-year-old boy had chosen 19-year-old Charles Manny Pona out of a lineup in a photo array. Hector's brother Carlos, who has a different last name, later approached Jennifer and asked her what she had seen. And she told Carlos, you know, everything that she had seen. And this ended up being more information that she was telling Carlos than what she had initially told police. So Carlos was like, hey, you know, they told me that you said this, this, and this, but it seems like you're telling me more information. Do you mind going back to the police and telling them more of this? I'm hoping it can help.
Mm.
And she's like, of course, you know, your brother was my friend. You guys are my neighbors. You know, I saw it happen. Of course, I'm going to go to the police and, you know, do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
She also ended up picking Charles's photograph out of an array. And she even signed her name across the top left corner of the photograph and then added the date. Carlos stated, quote, I asked her to talk. She did it because of me. I know she was scared after she went to court. She had to give her address and everything. That was wrong. She had to point him out. She's dead because she would help someone out. Charles Poner remained on the run for nearly 2 months before he was arrested on October 28, 1999, after a routine motor vehicle stop revealed that he had a warrant out for his arrest for the murder of Hector Feliciano. In addition to the witness statements, like you said, Liz, they found Charles's beeper or pager at the scene of the shooting, and his fingerprints were found on the Chevy Blazer. Jennifer and the 14-year-old witness both testified at a bail hearing on November 12th, both identifying him as the man they saw in or around the vacant lot when the shots were fired. That same evening, the 14-year-old boy's older sister was walking near their home when a car pulled up alongside her and just was slowly cruising along with her to match her speed.
So creepy.
The passenger rolled down the window, showed her a gun, and stated, "Where's your little brother?" This was reported to police. South Kingston Police Chief Vincent Vespio, one of three members of Rhode Island's Witness Protection Review Board, said that the board can implement protection within an hour of a request being made, and that protection includes relocation within the state or out of state for individuals as well as families. The 14-year-old boy's mother did in fact seek protection for her son, but said that it lasted only up until his next court appearance, which was just a few days later. She stated, quote, "He's safe only because he ran away from home to protect himself and his family. I haven't seen him in 6 months. How do you think that makes me feel? No one's protecting these children in South Providence."
That's awful. So scary, too. Especially when you bring in the rest of their family. Like, showing a gun to this poor boy. First of all, he's 14. Showing a gun to his sister and threatening her, that's... come on, that's so unnecessarily evil. That's awful. I hate that.
It's great. It's so fucked up.
So fucked up. So after this 14-year-old witness was like, okay, I'm getting the hell out of Dodge, understandably, Jennifer started to get death threats herself. And I think, you know, Carlos made a good point when he said that she, you know, she had to give her address and, her, you know, her full name, of course. That put a target on her back because she was very brave in testifying against Charles Pona at his bail hearing. She was, knowing the implications that it could be very bad for her, but doing it, of course, because she wanted to get justice for her neighbor. Very brave. But she started to get death threats immediately, and they were numerous, and they just continued. She told the Providence Police Department that she had been receiving these threats on her life, and they seemed to have a similar reaction to the boy, but it was a little too nonchalant, at least for my comfort.
Same.
Honestly, and as what we know what happens, you know, it really was. In late November of 1999, Charles was serving a 6-month sentence on an unrelated charge before he was going to be allowed to be on bail. A detective Finnegan confirmed that he had indeed heard about the threats on Jennifer's life and that he would get in touch with her. And the thing that baffles me the most is that they did not act in any sense of urgency. They didn't scramble. They didn't go and immediately, like, confirm or whatever, like, call up, go to her house, check in on her. They just were like, okay, we understand. Got the report. We will follow up. Pause. Like, there's no, like, okay, I would immediately, like, call, check in on the well-being, maybe have an officer posted or, like, follow up and say, like, do you want protection? Like, let's give you protection. How about that?
Right. And this is a 15-year-old girl.
Yes.
This isn't just some, like, not that everyone doesn't deserve witness protection.
Right.
But where she's 15 years old, it's not like she can get in a car and drive away.
Right.
She doesn't have a job.
Right.
Where's she gonna go with what money, with what, like, she's fully at the mercy of whoever wants her dead.
Of course.
And it blows my mind that they weren't more responsive. They weren't at all responsive, but they weren't more responsive because she's their star fucking witness.
Yeah. 100%.
They should have her escorted, like, four officers around her at all sides, like, north, east, west, and south.
Yes.
Like, oh my god, these cops should be walking her to school.
Yes.
Occupying the desks around her in class. Yes. Like, come on.
I'm with you. I'm with you. In January of 2000, Charles was still serving this 6-month sentence on unrelated charges. The Providence Police Department detective reached out to Jennifer's legal counselor regarding her witness testimony to make sure that he, too, was aware of these death threats and that it all was because of her willingness to testify against Charles Pona. And of course, you know, the counselor was like, yes, I'm aware. And, you know, they all were like, okay, so we're all established. We're all aware that Jennifer is getting death threats. Well, let's protect her. We want her to testify. We need her to testify so we can nail this guy, get justice for the 17-year-old boy who was needlessly killed. And honestly, I think to this day, we don't really know the motive. He just shot and killed this kid. So awful.
Right.
Charles Pona was released on bail on April 22nd, 2000, after completing that 6-month sentence. And the death threats were still happening. And this entire time, Jennifer was promised protection by the Providence Police Department, as well as the assistant attorney generals on the case. And this is the only reason Jennifer continued to agree to testify. Clearly, Jennifer felt she could trust these people, or maybe she felt that she was being pressured to still offer her testimony, because these death threats just continued and continued, and they were starting to get, like, more serious. Not that they weren't serious before, but they were starting to get, like, physical in a way. And we'll go over it in a second here, but it was getting legit. And as the trial neared closer, her life seemed like it was really on the line.
In the week leading up to her own murder, Jennifer kept asking her friends to walk her home from school. Even though she was typically known as independent and fearless, Jennifer told her friends point blank that she was scared, and she even said that she knew she was going to get shot eventually. Her friend Yesenia Capita stated, quote, "She said she didn't want to care, she wanted to show her face."
Yeah.
Like, she's really trying to live her life.
Yeah.
She's terrified, but she's trying not to show that she's terrified. Like, she's trying to be a brave girl.
Yeah.
It's horrendous.
On May 15th in 2000, a subpoena was issued to Jennifer to appear in court on May 22nd at 9:30 a.m. so she could testify against Charles Pona at the murder trial of Hector Feliciano. Apparently, on May 17th, just days before the trial, Jennifer shared with the assistant attorney generals, White and Page, that she was afraid to go to the court to testify because she believed she would be killed. As she had been before, Jennifer was once again promised that she would be protected so long as she was testifying. Just days, 5 days before she was to testify, still promised protection. And again, either she was pressured or she believed it because she said, okay, I'm still going to do it. This innocent little girl.
On May 21st, 2000, Jennifer was shot once in the neck and once in the head at close range by a man in a hooded sweatshirt just several feet outside her home as she was outside playing jump rope. The trial for the murder she was supposed to testify at was the next day. She passed away the next morning, the day the trial was supposed to take place, May 22nd, in the pediatric intensive care unit at the Rhode Island Hospital in Providence. A witness who lived near Jennifer said that he had heard 3 gunshots, and then he and a few other neighbors ran around the corner and found her on the ground bleeding. The 3rd shot had not struck Jennifer, but it was very clear that 3 shots had rang out.
Mm-hmm.
Charles's lawyers denied that he had any involvement in her murder, but as we know, he had been out on bail for the last month.
Yep.
Interestingly enough, law enforcement remained adamant that neither Jennifer or her friends ever said that they were afraid and in need of protection leading up to the trial.
Bullshit.
Unreal.
I can't even deal with that.
Jennifer's family and friends gathered outside of a makeshift memorial decorated with flowers, stuffed animals, and candles outside of her home, and all spoke about how she gave great advice, always looked on the bright side, and they talked about how at one point she had wanted to quit school because her dad had died of a heart attack just 1 year earlier, and she was like, I just can't go to school, I don't want to do this, I want to be at home, and so I think, too, that's why she was acting out in school, why she was getting into fights with teachers, getting into a lot of suspensions, like she was 14 at the time, maybe even 15. Her dad just died suddenly, tragically. She did not want to go to school.
Yeah.
And she's acting out. Like, that's just how it was.
Yeah.
But she was a great kid, and it was very, very clear how loved she was.
Yeah. She was very brave, too, it sounds like. I mean, to keep pushing and pushing and being willing to, or at least agreeing to testify. And I mean, see, after seeing what she saw, it's horrible. She was so brave.
Just hours before she died, Jennifer had been driving around Roger Williams Park with her friend, 16-year-old Eileen Caridad, who said that they were, quote, just having fun, she was okay. When her friends were asked by police if they would testify or tell police if they had seen anything, they said no. Her good friend Nina stated, quote, I'd be afraid for myself. It can happen to anybody again.
Yeah. You know, of course, like you said, Katie, Charles was out on bail, but he denied it immediately. He was like, I had nothing to do with this, y'all. Like, come on. Why would I? I'm going on trial tomorrow, yo. He was being under close watch, of course. I mean, thanks to the very near murder trial. And, like, surely he could not have been responsible. And the prosecutor on the case for Hector Feliciano, he immediately asked that Charles' bail be revoked because his trial now was going to be pushed back because, you know, the star witness was murdered very coincidentally the day before. And for some reason, this judge refused to take his bail away. Don't worry, though. Instead, they gave him a curfew of 11 p.m. and required him to check in with the court clerk daily. Perfect. So between the hours of, I don't know, 6 a.m. and, you know, maybe he goes to check in the court at 9 a.m. and then from 9 a.m. to, I don't know, 11 p.m. he's just gonna be innocent all day. Come on. So dumb. Put his ass back in jail until you can absolutely prove it wasn't him. It's ridiculous. So if it wasn't innocent little Charles, then who killed Jennifer Rivera, right? And so obviously, since it was the murder of the star witness in a murder trial, the day before the murder trial, Charles and the people around him started to be looked into very quickly. And it wasn't long until details started to come out and people around him started to show their true colors and stories started to be revealed. And that's how we kind of got the full story coming into play.
At Charles's trial for Jennifer's murder, multiple witnesses testified against him. Detective James Marsland, who had spoken to Jennifer at the scene of Hector's homicide, Kong Meng Li, who testified to hearing gunshots and then seeing someone run from the scene of Jennifer's murder, Officer Stephen Gensarella and Officer Joseph Donnelly, who both had arrived on the scene after Jennifer was shot, Officer Vincent Mansolillo and Officer Stephen Mockler, who had both spoken with Miguel Perez about Charles's participation in Jennifer's murder, Elizabeth La Posada, the medical examiner who conducted Jennifer's autopsy, Dennis Fullen, who was housed at the Adult Correctional Institution with Charles, Denard Walker, who confessed to committing Jennifer's murder, and Miguel Perez, as previously mentioned, who confessed to driving the vehicle that Walker and Charles escaped in after the shooting.
So now it's all coming together. They knew Charles was responsible somehow, whether he shot or he was conspiracy, whatever. So now they had all these players. And this is kind of how it played out. So after the bail hearing where the 14-year-old spoke and Jennifer spoke, but before he was out on bail, so he was serving that 6-month sentence, he had a cellmate, like you just said, Dennis Fullen, who later testified. Now, apparently, Dennis and Charles would occasionally chit-chat, just shoot the shit, about Hector's murder. And Dennis claims that, at first, Charles openly considered paying Jennifer to not testify against him. But according to Dennis, Charles expressed that he also wanted to, quote, get rid of her, and that he, quote, had to dump her. Charles would also share with his bunkie, Dennis, that he had two people who would do the job for him. His half-brother, Denard Walker, that you also mentioned, and his friend, Miguel Perez, who you also just mentioned. Two people who ended up testifying against Charles Pona in the murder. of Jennifer Rivera. Charles expressed hopes of getting out on bail so he could make sure that Jennifer would be handled properly, which is not only super evil, but also really fucked up and terrible and awful, and he's the worst. While Charles was in jail, Miguel Perez would often visit him, and they would openly discuss Charles' upcoming murder trial, especially highlighting the aspect of Jennifer's testimony and how that literally would really fuck up his case. Reportedly, Charles often told Miguel that Jennifer, quote, has got to go, and that he and his half-brother, Denard, quote, needed to handle that. Apparently, according to a law document, after conversing with Charles for some time about a potential plan to silence Jennifer versus just paying her off, Miguel testified that he had a conversation with Charles, and he told him that he had found Jennifer while she was walking down the street, and in an attempt to intimidate and scare her, Miguel got out of his car and fired his gun in the air. This definitely scared Jennifer, as it would scare any of us, because duh, but it didn't harm her physically in any way. When Miguel went back to visit Charles in jail and told him about this encounter, he told him that the gun had jammed and that he really intended on killing her, but it just ended up not happening like that. And Charles got so pissed about this, he was like, you fool, how dare you? Like, now she knows she's in danger. And he was so pissed about this, you know, calling him an idiot and like saying you're fucking dumb and all that stuff. And that, like, this could be bad because now she could run away or, like, go to the police or whatever. But it didn't end up mattering because very shortly after this, Jennifer was murdered.
Once Charles was released, the three men drove to Jennifer's home, saw her outside playing, and then circled the block. Denard Walker got out of the car and Charles stated, quote, make sure you do it right. Denard replied, quote, don't worry, you can't do life. Miguel then told him to meet them at their prearranged location near Jennifer's home. Miguel testified that he and Charles drove to the second location, heard three gunshots, and that Denard ran to the car. Miguel then says that Denard stated, quote, I got her, jet, we gotta go. Charles then told Denard that he loved him.
Oh, jeez.
Miguel testified that after Jennifer's murder, he was back at the ACI, the Adult Correctional Institution, on unrelated charges and received a letter from Charles. Charles wrote that he had been visited by police officers in regards to Jennifer's murder and that he was trying to get an appeal. The letter was obviously admitted into evidence and read to the jury over Charles's objections. He tried to argue that the reference to his appeal indicated that he was convicted for Hector's murder and that it was unfairly prejudicial. The objection was overruled, reasoning that there had already been instructions to the jurors not to infer anything from Charles's previous incarceration.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Denard Walker then testified. He had already pled guilty to conspiring with Charles and Miguel to kill Jennifer, but once he was on the witness stand, he was adamant that it was only him there that killed Jennifer and that Miguel and Charles were nowhere to be found. He said that he had decided to kill Jennifer all on his own, and obviously this not only contradicts what he said when he pled guilty,
right,
but contradicts a tape-recorded conversation he had at the Adult Correctional Institution with Dennis Fullen.
Jesus Christ. Come on, man. I admire wanting to protect your bro and all that, but come on.
Right, and a little too late.
Yeah, nice, yeah. First and foremost, Charles was in fact found guilty of first-degree murder of 17-year-old Hector Feliciano, as well as carrying a pistol without a license and attempted arson. Naturally, he did attempt to appeal these charges, but it was denied. Sucks to suck. For Jennifer's murder, Charles was sentenced to life in prison for the murder charge and 10 years for conspiracy to commit murder. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison for carrying a pistol without a license, 10 years for using a firearm while committing a crime of violence, and a 5-year sentence for obstruction of justice. These were all to be served consecutively with his life sentence from the murder of Hector Feliciano. Because Charles is a little loser boy, he did try and appeal the shit out of this murder trial as well. Nobody's surprised. He actually ended up having 2 trials for Jennifer's murder after being granted a retrial in 2010. But despite that, despite 2 appeals, Charles' charges remained. And that fucker is still in jail to this day. Good riddance.
Since Jennifer's death, the Rhode Island Attorney General's office created a witness protection program, I should rephrase, a better witness protection program, to offer support and protection to those who offer information to help solve crimes. Would have been great to have had this already in place. You know, they claimed to have had this already in place. Would have been nice, but, you know, I hope it's working now. On Niagara Street in Providence, there is now the Jennifer Rivera Memorial Park, and it's located just several blocks from her old home.
Very nice. And that is the awful murder of Jennifer Rivera, a beautiful 15-year-old girl who really was just trying to do something that she, of course, felt necessary for her neighbor and friend, also murdered 17-year-old Hector Feliciano at the hands of a terrible man, Charles Pona, who is rotting in jail for the rest of his life. And of course, you guys already know, we want to know what you think. Please give us your thoughts and your opinions on this case. You can find us on Instagram at truecrimene.
All lowercase.
And you can send us an email at truecrimene@gmail.com.
We also, of course, have a website, truecrimene.com. You can go to our contact page and use our handy-dandy submission tool to send us questions, comments, concerns, your thoughts on this case, other cases we've covered, and you can even use it to suggest cases to us, like the one we just covered. Thank you again, Mary Beth L.
Thank you.
And if you guys want to be anonymous, that is always, always, always an option as well. And if you guys are thinking, wow, I really like this episode, I really like this podcast, good job, Katie and Liz, you guys can scroll down a little bit further to our Buy Us a Coffee section. You can click the button that says thank you and go to our Buy Us a Coffee page, where you can buy myself a coffee and Liz a non-coffee related but caffeinated Beveragino.
Yes.
But like we always say, you guys seriously do not have to spend a single cent on us. We'd actually prefer that you did not, but we're just giving you guys the option just in case. But if you are thinking, you know, hey, I want to still show you guys some appreciation, but inflation, times are hard.
Sure.
If you are a Spotify listener, you can go to Spotify and give us a star rating on our page. If you're more of an Apple Podcast kind of listener, you can go to our page on there and give us a star rating and or a written review. However, you do not have to do any of those things because you guys just being here and listening, especially for cases like the ones we just told you, means so much to us and we could not thank you enough.
Absolutely. Well said, Katie. With that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.